ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
So alarmed was one of Australia's leading newspapers about computers taking over jobs that in July it ran a special series entitled The Computer Holocaust. What are we going to do with the unemployed? It was July 1978. The Armageddon, foreseen then by the Australian newspaper, didn't happen. Back then, only 57% of the working age population was employed. It's now 64%, not too far off an all-time high. But getting out of the first computing revolution with employment intact, even as some workers, typists among them, lost their jobs, doesn't mean we'll be able to get out of this one, the potentially far bigger artificial intelligence revolution, with anything like the same assurance we'll still have jobs to go to. There's talk of basic income payments to give those of us without jobs money to spend. There's talk of having to adjust to a new post-employment world. There's talk of Armageddon. But we've heard it before, and it didn't happen. So it won't this time, will it? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and one of the best people in the world to assess what AI is doing to work and the way we work, Joshua Gans. Joshua is an innovation specialist and former Young Australian Economist of the Year, now with the University of Toronto. He's written three books about the economics of AI, one of which came out a few years before ChatGPT, and the other, through a remarkable coincidence, in the month ChatGPT was released. And one of Australia's top economic modellers, Janine Dixon, who runs the Centre for Policy Studies at Victoria University. They've just modelled the likely effect of AI on 97 Australian occupations, each broken down into specific tasks. Quite an achievement. Welcome, Joshua, and welcome back, Janine.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Janine, we've just had two reports. The Australian government's, which finds AI hasn't much damaged employment in the industries exposed to it yet, and yours, which looks forward. Different jobs will be affected by AI differently. What did you do?
We took a long view. We looked at the impact of AI on jobs in a very detailed way. Based on work by Jobs and Skills Australia, Jobs and Skills Australia went through in a very detailed way the occupations that we all do, which they broke into tasks, and then they assessed every task on the basis that AI could automate that task, AI could augment that task, or perhaps AI couldn't do anything and the task would continue to be performed much as it is today.
And you found 47% of tasks will be augmented and only 9% fully automated. But that doesn't mean that 9% of jobs will go. Nor does it mean it's only 47% of jobs that will be augmented.
That's right. It's not so much that 47% of jobs will be augmented, but more like perhaps nearly all jobs will be augmented to the tune of about 47% of the tasks that the people are doing. Similarly, it's not like 9% of jobs will simply be automated out of existence, but perhaps more like 9% of the things we're doing today will be instead displaced by AI.
Do we know anything from your modelling about what will happen to total employment in Australia, to unemployment?
this could take 10, 20, 30 years to really unfold. So the thing is, we shouldn't be preparing young people today to work in those types of jobs. Just like we don't prepare young people today to be typists, we don't prepare young people today to be blacksmiths. A larger economy will have more jobs in it, particularly around the care economy. So preparing young people to work in those types of roles and preparing policy to employ people in those types of roles.
Joshua, automation has wiped out particular jobs. We mentioned typists earlier, but not always quickly. Can you tell us about one of the biggest waves of job destruction in the US, the one that wiped out telephone operators, the people who connect phone calls?
I have to start by attacking the premise of your question. As I understand it, people are typing more than ever.
But it's you and me.
Yes, it is. There is no separate role for a typist, that is true. But now people are typing for themselves and they're doing a worse job than any typist ever did, which is illustrating an important point. You can identify a task, but it may be what happens to that task is it morphs a bit and it becomes part of a different job. With respect to the question that you did ask, there have been waves of automation. The largest job category during the mid-20th century or so were switchboard operators.
People would know what they did only from seeing movies, I guess, a lot of people.
Switchboard operators, I mean, if you watch Marvelous Miss Maisel or something like that, you see some of those things where a call would come in and somebody, usually a woman, it was a huge employer of women, would answer the call and direct it and do so by literally plugging in a wire to connect the two calls. So it was a very manual task. In the 1970s, the very last switchboard operator was shut down in the United States. The interesting thing about that is that the technology that was used to automate the switch was developed in 1890, very shortly after the development of the telephone itself.
90 years before the last switchboard operator lost her job.
Exactly. That is not exactly what we call as being wiped out by automation. And it's also not the case that it happened in one of these situations where they developed an automated thing and they weren't thinking about eliminating the jobs. In fact, the very person who developed the automated switch was a guy called Armin Stoiger, who was in Kansas in a very small town. His other occupation was being a funeral director. And this town had two funeral directors. Unfortunately for him, the wife of the other funeral director was the switchboard operator. So he suspected that, when business came in, he wasn't getting the business he deserved because of this. Some people just let that go or complain. He developed an automated telephone switch, and with it, the telephone with the rotary dial and all of those other things with it, and deployed it in that town and eliminated that job.
He actually wanted to destroy telephone operators.
Yeah.
He actually wanted to exterminate that category of employment.
Yes, he is the Montgomery Burns of his day because he hated these particular workers, but they took 90 years. 90 years before he finally got his switch. And during that time, the number of switchboard operators, of course, exploded in numbers. So what he would have seen was the exact opposite. But it just goes to show these things can take time. But it also goes to show, and this is something where I instinctively reacted to Janine's discussion about trying to forecast these things. You know, there's just a tremendous amount of uncertainty about, you know, even if you can identify today which tasks might be amenable to some form of automation by AI, and of course there's a big industry in trying to study that, but also people trying to actually do it. You know, when it comes down to it, there's probably a handful of a couple of hundred people who actually know what the AI will be doing in 2 years' time, and none of the rest of us know.
You have put your name to a petition, I suppose, signed by 3,000 economists and technologists, some of them Nobel Prize winners, saying that there's a risk of really fast change in the next 10 years and calling for action. Is it right that this revolution, this industrial revolution, might be much faster than the computing revolution of the 70s, than the earlier ones we know about?
The reason I was happy to sign is because I actually think that the issues that we're facing regarding cybersecurity in the short term are quite massive. I think we're going to look, and you can play this back when you do next year's episode or something. I think in 2027 is going to be a dumpster fire of cybersecurity issues. And I am very concerned that governments haven't been really thinking about what sort of, you know, economic regulation needs to be done. At the moment, it's just basically instinctive gut reactions, but it's a, you know, it's a complicated set of interrelated trade-offs. And so that's why I think, you know, work needs to be done quite urgently on that.
What about the types of jobs that are likely to be the winners and the losers, Janine? And I ask that noting, as Joshua said, that the future is uncertain, and this future is particularly uncertain.
Yes, of course the future is uncertain. And we sit here in 2026, and in 10 years' time, we may well look back and have a good chuckle at what we're saying today. But the types of jobs that we're seeing expanding in a larger economy, more construction, right? And a lot of those tech and trade type jobs are pretty hands-on and not so likely to be done by AI. Also caring jobs. So you have this growth, if anything, in roles that used to be roles that were likely to be automated out of existence. So it's a bit of a reversal of some of
the recent... So we'll lose the white-collar jobs. Some of them, maybe lots of them, the jobs which have previously been at risk, these are the manufacturing jobs among them in Australia. We used to talk of the Rust Belt. They're actually the jobs most secure.
In a sense, yes. So it's a bit of a reversal relative to other waves of technological change. But really the key at an individual level is to be adaptable, to be curious, to learn the tools. So AI literacy will be emerging as a really important skill, just as digital literacy was before.
So if I want to keep my job, using the tools will help, but it won't guarantee all existing white-collar jobs.
Peter, can I turn around that last phrase a little?
Yes.
You said if you want to keep your job. I would just like to rephrase that a little to if you want to stay employed. Let's not stay so absolutely connected to the job that you have. If you want to stay employed, then you need to be adaptable.
So if you want to be employed, it's a reversal perhaps of how things used to be, a bit like the biblical phrase that the last will be first this time, which is blue-collar workers, and the first, white-collar workers, will be last. I occasionally like to get biblical references into The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guests bold enough to attempt to come to grips with the industrial revolution we're suddenly in the midst of, AI specialist Joshua Gans at the University of Toronto and economic modeller Janine Dixon at Victoria University. Joshua, we've looked at jobs. Can I ask a slightly different question about workers? Within each job, within each workplace, what type of workers are likely to do the best? Those with low skills or high skills?
Well, what is a skill? there's a skill that we get through formal education. That's worth something. I'm in that business. I should like that skill. Then there is the skills that we get from years and years of experience, life, jobs, doing other things, etc. Well, if we go back to what AI is able to do, AI is able to provide predictive tools, but invariably it has to be combined in order to be useful with the judgment of humans. There's no AI in the world that exists without the judgment of humans, whether it's at the time you're using it or at the time you programmed it initially. So what that said, yes, and we said this back in our 2018 book, is that the skills that you need are judgment skills and they come from experience. And some of the initial evidence we've already seen on where AI is having an impact is very consistent with that effect. You know, in AI-exposed jobs, the younger folks may be having a reduction in employment opportunities, but the older folks in AI-exposed jobs are having an increase in employment opportunities. And so, you know, that suggests a complementarity between experience and AI use. That also immediately suggests a problem. And the problem is, where are the young people who are losing out on the employment opportunities potentially going to get that experience? And so that is, I think, probably the first order challenge that we're going to face in the next few years regarding how AI starts to infiltrate and impact on the workforce.
Well, how can you educate? Indeed, can you even educate anymore? It's certainly very hard to assess students anymore. How can you prepare people for jobs that you're saying these days actually experience will be terribly, terribly important in applying that kind of judgment that you can't do if you're just using the output of a machine?
It is extremely challenging, but let's not take the premise. You talk about the students using AI to cheat. You know, that's what it looks like. It's the way a lot of people use AI currently, is to do whatever work they were doing much easily and see if they can get away with it.
You have both used AI in your published publications, including the one we're talking about from Janine. So you're using AI yourself.
Yeah, no, exactly. You'll use those ones. And the thing is, you know, so it's the same activity. And so, you know, if the students have been learning how to use AI by working out how to get their grades up, then so long as the assessment is actually relevant to their jobs, that's a big if, then great. Then it's all good. You know, at some point, those skills of learning how to work during university are going to translate into the very white-collar jobs that you're worried about.
Yeah, I think as educators, we need to reframe what it means to be cheating. When I was in secondary school in the late 80s, early 90s, it was considered cheating to use cut and paste. And now we know that that's a simple tool. It's useful and helpful. It helps us with our writing. So, you know, we need to reframe what that means.
It was considered cheating to use calculators, Janine, when I was in school.
It was considered cheating to use a computer in law school. You know, this has happened all the time. But Peter, you need to understand that you're currently in the most protected job from AI.
No, but am I? I mean, people can write, AI can write and read stories on the radio.
Yes, yes. That's the task-based approach. The task-based approach is, yes, we can work out a way of trying to imitate that sort of thing. But, you know, invariably, and I think, and there'll be some roles for things that you might have otherwise done. But ultimately, you are in a 100% relationship business. That means that your audience expects you to say stuff and to come up with things and to ask questions and what have you. If you started using AI to, you know, duplicate yourself and things like that, your audience would fall straight off. And the reason is there's something about your perspective. There's something about things that have been brought out. There's something about your judgment, etc. And people do not like to sit down and listen to opinions, you know, essentially from Clippy from Microsoft Word. So we can use AI to do communication when no one's going to read it, like 98% of white collar jobs. But in the jobs like your one, I don't think that's the case at all. I think there'll still be that demand. We can call it authenticity, we can call it whatever. That's what it is.
Also, you've said that there are a number of tasks, skills in jobs, which are not apparent from the job description. You use the example of someone who drives a school bus. That task could be automated. In fact, it could probably be done more safely.
Right.
But you've said you wouldn't do it.
Well, I don't think parents are going to put their kids on a driverless bus. Why? Because the bus driver has another function, which they can't do very well at the moment, but their other function is to protect the kids from each other. Without a driver in the bus, that's a whole lot of unsupervised kids. And if you don't eliminate the driver from the bus, you don't get the savings in pay. Now, it may be that the person who sits on an automated bus is not a skilled at driving in the way that they currently are, and they have other skills. But we're not going to replace the job of someone on a bus. We're not going to replace it because that person has a job, and that job cannot currently be done by something that can just drive.
Janine, your other key finding, apart from jobs, is that the adoption of AI is likely to make us better off financially, quite a lot better off. What did you find?
So the adoption of AI means that as a society, we can produce more stuff, more goods and services with the workers that we have. But the distribution of that economic growth is interesting. And what we find in our modelling is that a lot of the benefit of that growth will fall to capital owners rather than workers. That's not to say that both sides won't benefit, but workers will benefit to a much lesser extent through growth in wage income, basically. They'll benefit to a much lesser extent than capital owners. And that produces a whole new challenge as this technology grows and develops. It creates challenges around income distribution. It creates challenges around keeping income in this country. If a lot of the AI infrastructure is foreign-owned, then the income doesn't even stay in this country. So it creates a whole new challenge around taxation, creates a whole new challenge around the social safety net. As pockets of society become more wealthy relative to others, that creates challenges around housing. A lot of the growth in incomes that we've seen has basically wound up in really inflated values of our housing stock. So these are all dangers that would need to be managed. But the bottom line is there is a growth dividend from AI technology. It's just going to be a really interesting and challenging problem as to how that dividend is distributed.
Should this be part of the Prime Minister's new Office of AI? He's announced the office. He hasn't said exactly what it'll do. But things such as taxing money leaving the country, there'll be a lot more if AI makes the profits that people are talking about, and I suppose a social safety net, or even as lots of the tech billionaires, perhaps for self-interested reasons, they want customers, they're making a case for a basic income, for something paid to everyone.
God, no, the AI office should not do any of that stuff. I don't think we should be abandoning free trade, capital flows, social security things as we've currently had them, or any of those things on the basis of speculation regarding the alternative mix of capital and labour. We've had this before. Every single technological revolution says, oh, people are spending capital, therefore there's going to be a change in the distribution. There have been changes in the distribution of income, there's no doubt. But, you know, that is a set of complicated things that probably have nothing to do with AI at all. And it's completely unclear whether AI will harm or hurt. For instance, right at the moment, anyone using AI in the workplace, they're getting all the dividends. They're getting all the dividends. They're getting the time off that they can spend with their kids and look like they're working.
I could be, if I used an AI voice for this, I could be sitting at home.
Yeah, you'd lose your job pretty quickly if you did that. But nonetheless, no, you still have to work, Peter. That's what I told you. You can't get away with it.
I agree. The Office of AI is an Office of AI. It's not an Office of Economic Policy. Income distribution, wealth distribution are ongoing challenges for the Treasury, for the Department of the Prime Minister and so forth. I do think that the advent of AI will probably make it all the more challenging. But another challenge is data centres using a lot of electricity, using a lot of water, and creating price pressure on those essentials that the population consumes and relies on.
What do you think, Joshua, about the need to compensate losers? We did that to a small extent, admittedly, when the car industry closed, which had been brought on by the government in some respects. It helped speed the closure of the car industry.
You do the thing that Australia has not done for 40 years, which is take the HEX system and expand it to be a broad social insurance system.
This is student loans.
Yeah, that's student loans, but no, loans in general. You know, it was solving a financial problem. Invariably, any of these issues of being laid off and having to reskill and other things like that are similarly a financial issue. People can't easily borrow to stay in their house while they get retrained. Australia has a world-leading pioneered system for this and has never expanded it at all. And it is just crazy to me. It's just crazy.
That's a very creative idea, and I'm sure Bruce Chapman would be delighted to hear you saying that. It's not going to be possible to say that so-and-so lost their job because of AI and therefore deserves some special type of compensation. That's just not practical. What we need to focus on is a strong social safety net in this country, and that will see us through challenges from AI and from any other events that affect employment or incomes.
You're each providing some sort of reassurance that as far as we know, things won't be that bad because people will have time to move into new jobs. Can I ask finally, each of you, whether, you know, that reassurance is great, but whether you've got any doubt? I sort of understand the reassurance and I have doubt. I understand that every industrial revolution has turned out well for employment and for wealth. But that doesn't mean that this one will, because it's so much faster. Are you a person who has doubt generally, Joshua? Do you have doubt about this?
Everything I've seen thus far with AI gives me no evidence or hasn't changed my view things are going to be just fine. You know, I think we could get some disruption from all sorts of stuff, but on the job front, I think things are going to be fine. Every use of AI I've ever had has only reaffirmed to me the value of what the humans and what people are putting into their jobs.
Janine.
Yeah, look, humans work in order to create goods and services and value for humans. If AI can do some of that stuff for us, there's plenty of other things that humans can be doing for other humans. The composition of the job market has changed markedly from generation to generation. Our kids will probably be doing jobs that we haven't heard of yet, but I also feel pretty confident that they'll be doing something. People will still be employed.
Well, in a sense, you're backing your judgment because you both have children, as I do, who will need to work in this new environment. Janine, Joshua, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Joshua?
I think we're just going to get a cascade of news on AI. That's not going to let up for quite some time.
Which is good for you, Janine.
I was just going to say, keep an eye out as the government puts the final touches, or maybe they're not even final yet, on reforms to negative gearing and capital gains tax. I think what we're seeing now is policy detail coming in after a policy announcement, and we're seeing policy being created in real time.
We certainly are. There are changes even this week in what the government announced two or so months ago. Thank you so much, economic modeller Janine Dixon, who alongside her co-author James Lennox has just modelled the likely effect of AI on 97 Australian occupations at the Centre for Policy Studies at Victoria University. And Joshua Gans, not only a former Young Australian Economist of the Year, but the first Young Australian Economist of the Year, now a specialist in AI and innovation at the University of Toronto, something which, as he said, is likely to keep him busy for some time. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid. You can email us economy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.